This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason. To live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast.
What's going on, everybody? First off, I want to say Merry Christmas to all of you. We're publishing this episode on Christmas Eve because it's just a really inspiring story. The guest today is Mr. Remy Adeleke. And Remy was born in Nigeria to a wealthy family. And when he was 5 years old, his father died. And the Nigerian government took his family's money, took everything. And so his mother was forced to take Remy. His mother was American, forced to take Remy and move them to the Bronx, New York City. And so Remy grew up in a really rough environment. By his teenage years, he was dealing drugs. He was running scams. And he was going down a really dark path. And one day, he decided after a drug deal gone wrong that he wanted to join the military. That not only did he want to join the military, he wanted to become a Navy SEAL. And so went down to the recruiter's office. He had some warrants on his record. He had to go through a bunch of things to get those warrants expunged. And that's a twist of fate we'll talk about during the episode. But he got into the Navy. He went through Navy boot camp, went through BUDS the first time, failed out, and then eventually got back into BUDS, completed BUDS, became a Navy SEAL, and went on to serve 13 years in that organization. Really inspiring story if we just stop there, but once Remy got out of the Navy, he was in a position where he didn't know what he was going to do. And so through a few more twists of fate, he found himself trying out for some movies. And he got a role in the latest Transformers movie, Transformers 2. And just a really, really inspiring story here. He's got a book coming out called Transformed. It's coming out in April. And you're going to get so much from this conversation as far as how Remy was able to turn his life around several different times. The sheer amount of faith this man has in just believing in himself and never giving up, never quitting. So really awesome conversation we've got here. Before we get into it, I just want to say a couple of things. If you haven't been to this podcast before, this is the Warrior Soul Podcast. And here we deliver tools, tactics, and strategies to the U.S. military veteran community to help them to live their best lives. The reason why we do it is because over the past decade and a half of war, we've faced a lot of things as a community. High suicide rates, high rates of veteran homelessness, high rates of chronic disease and depression. And there's a lot of people out there trying to raise awareness about these issues, but I don't want to just raise awareness. I want to deliver solutions. So every time you listen to one of these episodes, you're going to find a story, a strategy, a tactic, or something that you can apply to your life right after you listen. And if you're not a veteran, stick around because everything we're going to go over here today could benefit you as well. I also want to say this, you know, we don't do a lot of marketing or advertising around this podcast. Everything is sheerly done through referrals, right? So that means that all we ask of you is that you share these episodes out, that you let other people know about the show so that it can help them as well. And if you can, pay us the highest compliment by writing us a written review on iTunes. It really helps us let other people know about the mission and what we're doing here. Beyond that, I just want to say that this podcast would not be possible without the good people at F-Bomb Nutrition, really awesome company run by amazing people. They make delicious packets of fats, macadamia nut butters. They mix them up with chocolate, with sea salt, with pecan butter, with coconut butter. Really delicious stuff, and they got a new product out, their cheese crisps. cheese crisps. They flavor them up with buffalo. They flavor them up with chili. Really good stuff. If you want to try out F-Bombs, you can head over to www.dropanfbomb.com and you can use the code WarriorSoul at checkout to get 20% off your first order. With that, let's get into this inspiring conversation with Mr. Remy Adelecki. What's going on, everybody? This is Chris Albert here. And listen, I got a really awesome guest for you guys this week. Super inspiring. Just an absolutely amazing story. Remy Adelecki is here today. And Remy, first off, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on. Thanks for having me, brother.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was reading a lot about your story. And first things first, it's, you know, you went from Nigeria, moving to the Bronx, to, you know, getting yourself into a little trouble, and then onto the military and eventually onto the Navy SEALs, and then onto the movies. And I want to get into each step of that, but I want to take it back to the beginning first. You were born in Nigeria, right?
Yes, I was born in Western Africa. My father, he was a well-known Nigerian engineer. He engineered some big projects all around the world. One of his most notable projects is a project by the name of the Lagoon Development Project. And that was one of the first man-made islands in the world. We now know it as Banana Island. So we lived in Nigeria, and because of his success, not just in Nigeria, but outside of Nigeria, we were a very wealthy family. So we lived the life of opulence in Nigeria. I mean, Nigeria is very westernized because it was colonized by the Brits like that many decades ago. So they're very westernized, and national language is English. There are tribal languages, but for the most part, we lived a really, really good life. Cars, nannies, drivers, we flew all over the world. We had it all.
Wow. And so your father died at a very young age, right?
Yeah. So in 1987, this was very mysterious because my father was in a legal battle with the Nigerian government. So the Nigerian government had literally just stripped our family of everything. So we went from rich to poor. And then within like 2 days before my mom and I realized everything was gone, my father died in Nigeria. And that was 1987. So I was 5 at the time.
Wow. Do you have memories of him?
You know what? It's funny you bring that up because I was just thinking about that the other day, looking at my son. My oldest son is 5, about to be 5. And my youngest is going to be 4. And I honestly was asking myself, I wonder if something happened to me, would they remember me? Because I don't remember much of my dad, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I mean, my father left when I was, I think, 3 or 4. And I remember being 4, but I don't remember my father at all. I don't remember him at all. And it's funny how the human mind works like that. If something's not repetitive, it's not going to sit there with you.
I think it's funny you say that word repetitive, because that was something that came to mind. I said to myself when I was looking at my youngest son today, I said, you know, maybe because I'm in his life, if I was to just, because he, like, tomorrow he would remember who I was, you know. A week from now, you remember who I was. But I think as time passed, without being in this life on a repetitive, consistent basis, then that's when those memories kind of dissipate. It's a weird science behind it.
Yeah. It's so weird because I try so hard sometimes and to think back to that time period, because I never even had a picture or anything like that. And you know, you're left with a lot of questions. So, you know,
did you ever get a chance to meet him? Did you ever see him later in life, though?
I have no idea. No pictures. Know nothing, like nothing at all. And you know, my mom, and you probably can relate to this, you know, with a mom, whenever I asked my mom about something like that, it would be like, well, you don't need your dad, you know, everything's cool, everything, you know. But did you have a lot of questions growing up? Did it reflect back on you as far as, you know, your self-confidence and things like that?
No, you know what? It's because of the loss of my father.
Yeah.
Man, not until I think one time when I was 8, I remember I was 8 years old, and We were in the bedroom that me and my brother shared. It was a small little room. And we had the bare minimum in there, man. I remember we had this wooden dresser and we had this lamp that didn't have a shade on it. And we had these pull-out beds that we would share and sleep on. And I just remember looking around my room and realizing, wow, we don't have much of anything. Like, you know, we're not dirt poor, but we don't have anything, you know? Right. And I remember staring at the picture of my father. And then I was just started asking myself, like, I wonder if my dad was here, would my life be different? And I broke down crying. And I just remember my mom came in and she was like, what's wrong? And I said, if my father was alive, our life would be different. Like, the reason why we live the way we live is because I don't have a father. So I associated a father with financial security.
Wow.
So yeah, that was when I was 8. I'll never forget that.
Yeah. It's funny how it works because, you know, I was horrible at baseball when I was younger. And, you know, when it hit me was going to baseball practice and, you know, not knowing how to throw a baseball, not knowing how to swing a bat, that kind of stuff. And I had a similar moment. That's insane. So you literally went from having a lot of wealth in Nigeria to being forced to move to the United States, to the Bronx, and then kind of having to start all over again.
Yeah. So, my mom's a trooper, man. I credit a lot of it to my mom. She held it together after my father died. And she shares this story with me right like days after my father died. My mom was American. So my mom met my dad in New York, and then they got married, and then she moved to Nigeria with him. So that's why after he died, she was just like, there's no way I'm raising my kids in Nigeria. I'm bringing them to the States. But it was hard. When she got back to the States, she called up a family member and asked this family member who had some money, hey, my family has, my kids have nothing. We have no food. We have no nothing. Is there anything that you can do to help us out with? And this family member said, hold on, let me call you back in 5 minutes. 5 minutes later, his wife called my mom back and said, how dare you call my husband asking him for money? Don't you ever call my husband asking for money ever again? And click, hung up the phone on my mom. This is like days after my dad died. I think it was at that point that my mom realized, like, I have nothing and I'm in the Bronx with these two kids. And it was really, really rough. There were times when I remember going to the office, but she had to pay the rent or whatever. And she would have to ask for extensions. I remember there were times, my brother remembers this better than I do, but there were times when my mom didn't have enough food to feed herself. She had just enough food to feed my brother and I. So she would put the food on the table and she would stand in the doorway of the kitchen and watch us to make sure that we ate the food. It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. And then, you know, growing up in the Bronx, especially in the 80s, you know, the crack epidemic, we lived in somewhat of a, I don't even want to say it was like a middle-class neighborhood. It was, but it was slapdash. It was in the middle of like one of the most poorest districts in the Bronx. And so, you know, I would walk out our community and there were crackheads on the street, people getting robbed, jumped, killed. I mean, it was a bust. It was rough. It wasn't easy. My mom did a good job of trying to protect us from the elements, I would say. But, you know, there were times when it crept in. I remember when I was a kid, my apartment got robbed, multiple times by a crackhead, you know, and it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. But, you know, when looking back, that was the best environment for me because it really, instilled in me perseverance. It really instilled in me this mindset that, you know what, there's nothing that I can't do. You can make it in the Bronx, you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. So it was a hard environment, but it proved to prepare me for my future.
Yeah, I think people forget what New York City was like in general during the 1980s. Because you go there now, even the Bronx is very different. I mean, it's still not the most economically prosperous borough, but it was way different back in the 1980s than it is today. My mom's from North Jersey and we used to go down to that area all the time and it was like a different world.
It was. I remember, isn't that, I remember going into the bodegas because the Dominicans where I grew up, they owned, well, they worked at a lot of bodegas. They owned a random bodegas on Fordham Road, which was the street I grew up on. And I remember going into the store one day and seeing mafia guys, straight up mafia guys, Italian mafia guys walk in and shake the owner down, like, hey, where's your rent? You're supposed to pay us. So, I mean, not only did you have the gangs, not only did you have the crack, which is crack epidemic was huge, but you had the mafia, you know, John Gotti, all of those goons. I mean, that was a big, big deal around that time, you know. So it's a jungle, man.
What do you think? Because I know you ended up getting a little bit of trouble yourself, but what do you think really saved you during that time? Was it your mom? Did you have a natural mindset that said, you know what, this is my line, I'm not going to cross it? What was it?
Well, it definitely was my mom's discipline, I would say. When I was a kid, she would spank us. You know, she didn't play around. She would give it to me and my brother. She would spank us with belts, extension cords. I mean, whatever. She would put her hands on, she would spank us. And what that did for me was that instilled this mindset that there are consequences for actions. There are always consequences. Like, in my mind, I always knew, even when I was selling drugs, even when I was, you know, running scams, bringing in thousands of dollars a week, you know, selling illegal phones to drug dealers, when I was doing all of this stuff, in my mind, I always knew if and when I get caught, there will be a consequence. So one day I got involved in a deal with a drug dealer, really, really bad. I talk about it in my book, so I won't go into all the details. But I had to pay him this money. I paid him his money. And after that, I was just like, that was like the consequence for me, because my life was threatened. My mom's life was threatened. And that was my, okay, you need to wake up, because this is getting real, real serious. So I credit it to my mom disciplining me the way she did when I was a kid, because that instilled, again, this mindset, there are consequences for action. So when I got into, that's when I really woke up and was like, I need to change a course.
When you started dealing drugs, how did that come about? Did somebody approach you and say, hey, I've got this opportunity for you? Or did you approach somebody and kind of seek it out? How did that start?
I wanted money. Yeah. I mean, it ain't nobody. I mean, that's the way it is. You know, I started out, you know, it started for me before even selling drugs. You know, I started out stealing from my mom the little money that she had. She used to have money under the mattress. I would take money under the mattress, and I would get, you know, I would steal from the local bodega stores, you know, and then that progressed to getting jobs and stealing from jobs. I had this crazy sneaker scam that I was running out of a sneaker store I was working at, where instead of charging the customers, I would charge them, but I would pocket the money and not ring it through the register. And then that progressed to selling drugs. I just wanted money. I mean, I wanted more money. I wanted more and more money. Nothing ever satisfied me. And that's when you're in that life, you are never satisfied. It doesn't matter how much money you make, you will always want more. And I just always wanted more. So how I got to it was, you know, my grandmother lived in Washington Heights. A lot of drugs are moved in and through Washington Heights, that whole area. And I knew a place where I could go buy what we call weed at the time, which was, you know, a lot of drugs. And I went and I bought it. I would buy it and I would go and I would sell it. And New York City at the time was saturated with drug dealers. Everybody was trying to be a drug dealer. So, and I wasn't trying to get in a competition with nobody and get into a shootout. So I went up to Poughkeepsie, New York, upstate New York, and I would sell drugs up there. Sell it, come back down, buy some more, go up and sell it. But I just wanted more. I wanted more. Even selling drugs wasn't enough for me, because it was just like, I was making money, but it was just like, I need to make more. So that's when I got involved in the illegal cell phone scam, where I was selling illegal phones to drug dealers. And at that point, I was bringing in thousands of dollars a week. I mean, I was bringing in like $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a week. And that's when I was like, okay. But and another thing was, I was big into music. I love hip hop music. I love hip hop culture. I grew up on it all, and I wanted to be a rapper, and I wanted to be in the music business. So what I did with the money, I wasn't just collecting the money just so I could buy a car, which I did do, or, you know, have nice things, which I did have, but I wanted it so that I could invest it into a record company. So I had a business mindset even at a young age. At 19, I started a record company. I had artists signed to me. We were going down to Virginia making music. I have a compilation album, which is still on my desk. I still keep it. That's the compilation.
Oh, that's awesome.
you know. So we had a compilation album. We had it. We had a good thing going. But the way I ran that money was I was ran a record company as I was funneling money from my legal activities into the record company. And so
it was kind of like you were financing your dream through the drugs, right?
All illegal activity. Yeah.
Right. And so when you were doing this, you know, at the time, like you said, the '80s was a crazy, crazy time. This is still the '80s, right? When you're
No. When I'm doing this, this is the nineties.
So
this is not late '90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
High school, out of high school. I graduated high school in 2000. So this is between, you know, high school and out. Being out of high school.
Yeah. So back then, like you're kind of looking around and, you know, you're looking at your community, you're looking at what's going on. Was there ever a point in your mind that said, oh my God, what am I doing? Like, what the heck am I doing right now?
Only when I hit that bottom, when I got involved in that deal that went bad, that was it. That was outside of that. I mean, I was reckless. I was doing a lot of crazy stuff, but I never questioned it. I was just like, I'm on the rise. I'm going to make it. I'm going to be this big CEO of a record company. I'm going to be like Jay-Z and all of these cats. So, but outside of that, no, it wasn't until I got involved in that deal that really shook me up that I was like, what the hell are you doing?
And so, you know, at this point, you're making money, all this stuff's coming in, and, you know, that's hard to walk away from, right? So what was your next thought when you said, all right, this happened, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
What am I going to do? What was your next thought?
I stayed home for 6 months and did nothing.
Really?
I did nothing for 6 months. Like, the only thing that I did do was I tried to shop this album that I just showed you. I tried to shop it to a record company, Def Jam Records. And I had one of the producers I was working with, he had a connection to Kevin Lyles. Kevin Lyles, anybody could look him up, but he was one of the biggest music executives at the time at Def Jam Records. Jay-Z, Ja Rule, DMX, all of these people were signed at Def Jam. And so I had a meeting with him to sell my record company to him, to shop my compilation album to him. And that was kind of like the only thing that I did try to do, was try to make it, because I had burnt all of the money illegally. After I had made him back the money, you know, I was putting all the money into the record company, and finally that dissipated. So my last ditch effort was to sell a record company and get a label deal. But when that didn't happen, I just stayed home for 6 months and did nothing. Nothing. And then in June of 2002, I was laying in my bed and I heard this voice speak to me, literally. Like, it was a voice, and that voice said, you need to get out of here. You need to join the military. Man, like, looking back, it was a crazy situation, because the military was contrary to everything I was. I hated the police. I hated anybody in the uniform. I remember being in high school and making fun of the ROTC kids because they went in tight uniforms. I hated authority. I liked my clothes baggy, my ass backwards. So there was no way I was going to join the military. So I remember having an argument, literally, with this voice in my room. You would have thought I was crazy. I was having an argument with this voice in my room. And finally, you know, after the argument ended, you know, I looked around in the same room that I broke down crying in, like, a decade plus earlier. And I was just like, what else do you have? You have nothing else. What else are you going to do with your life? So that's when I was like, okay, I'll try this military thing.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, I think, in the Northeast in general, and I'm talking across communities, joining the military is almost it's either an act of desperation or it's an act of rebellion.
Yeah.
I think, because, you know, it's just an interesting thing, because, you know, when I went into the military, it was an act of rebellion. My mother, I have an Italian mother. She said, I don't ever want you to go in the military. And when she learned I was joining the Marines, she chased me around my house with a broomstick. Like for like an hour, trying to break my leg so I couldn't go. And then, you know, but I also think, you know, there are so many people who look at the military as something a little bit more promising and a little bit more, where they could set their lives up from there. Right. If they feel like they have nothing else. And I feel like we're in those two camps, you know, the two of us, but you know, if somebody's trying to set their lives up, why do they choose to be a Navy SEAL? What was going through your head that said, I want to be at the tip of the spear?
Well, I'll back up for a little bit. Back in 1995, I saw a movie by the name of Bad Boys, and that kind of inspired me to kind of be a hero in a sense. And then a year later, a film by the name of The Rock came out, and that was the first time I ever saw or heard of Navy SEALs. And so when I saw that, I remember, you know, I'm this young ghetto kid from the Bronx, and I saw these dudes coming out the water. I'm like, yo, that's dope, man. Those guys are dope, man. Like, I want to do that. I want to be a Navy SEAL. But, you know, it wasn't a reality for me. It was just more, it's like me saying right now, I want to run for president. Like, yeah, like, it's going to happen. So, you know, after a few days, that whole idea kind of dissipated, and I went back to doing the things that I was doing. But when I finally made the decision to go and join the military, that's when I was like, okay, if I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna be part of the best. You know what I mean? I'm gonna be the best of the best. I'm not gonna just go in and just be in the Navy. I'm going to be whoever the best is, and the best in my mind at that time, and even to this day, you know, is the SEAL teams, you know? And so, but I, you know, I deal with a lot of issues with that. One, I couldn't swim. I was skinny. I didn't have the academic scores. And when I went to the recruiter, she ran my background. I had two warrants out of my arrest. I had a warrant in New Jersey and I had a warrant in New York. So I couldn't even get in the military, you know? So, but that's kind of why I chose.
Wow. Yeah. You know, The Rock got me too. When he's walking through the cemetery at the beginning and he's wearing those dress blues, I was like, yeah. Oh man, I got to do that.
It was
great. And some people will be like, what are these guys talking about? The Rock's the worst movie of all time. But got me. Yeah. It is a classic. But Nicolas Cage, I don't know. Nicolas Cage is a little bit crazy, man. Yeah. But so you're at this point, you make the decision, right? You say, I'm going to be part of the best of the best. Yeah. But you have these warrants out there. What do you do? Do you go handle the warrants? Do you go check everything?
Yes. Yeah, so what happened was after she ran my background and she found out I had the recruiter, I found out I had the warrants. I got up and I walked out the recruiter's office. I was like, dang, like I hear this voice telling me to join the military. I come to join the military and now I'm about to go to jail. So I'm thinking that she's going to call the cops on me. So I get up to leave. And she, right before I got to the door, she said, where you going? I said, I'm leaving. She said, I got warrants. I can't join the military. She said, do you have a suit? Do you have a suit? I said, no, I don't have a suit. She said, do you have a collared shirt or pants? I was like, yeah, I can get one. She said, come back tomorrow. So I came back the next day, and she took me to both judges, the judge in New York and the judge in New Jersey, fought on my advocate on my back. She was in her dress uniform. She said, this guy's trying to turn his life around. Like, what can we do for him? Like, you know, 9/11 had just happened. And so the judges both unanimously said that this guy's serious about turning his life around after the war, we'll clear his record. She cleared my record. So the judges cleared, expunged my record, but I still wasn't allowed to join because, as you know, when you go to MEPS, they ask you all these questions. Did your record get expunged? Did your record get sealed? Did you have a record? Did you recruiter tell you to say no? Like all these things. So anyway, she got it all cleared in such fast time that when I went to go MEPS, I was able to check no to everything. And she fudged my paperwork and that's how I got in. I snuck in.
Oh, wow. You owe that lady a lot. That's amazing, man.
She died 2 years later.
What was that?
She died two years later. Three years later.
How did she die?
She died. She had this autoimmune disease in her heart. And I just found that out when I was writing the book. When I finished writing the book, you know, my mom read the book and she was like, man, because she didn't know about the story. Because my mom didn't know everything that was going on when I joined the military because I straight up left. As a matter of fact, I told my mom that some guy, I lied to my mom and told her some guy stopped me on the street and told me he's putting me in the military and I got to go and I had no choice. And I remember she was crying. She was like, oh, you're going to die. Don't go to her. She lost it. But she didn't know what was going on. So when she read my book and she finally found out everything that happened, she was just like, you know what's going to happen one day, Remy? You're going to go to a book signing for this book and your recruiter's going to show up and she's going to, you know, she's going to she's going to be able to see how what she did made a difference. I was like, I hope so. And as soon as she said that, I got this thought in my mind because I had forgot my recruiter's name. And I said, oh, I got my military record. And so I ran to my office, this desk, and I pulled out my military record. I found her name, which I had forgotten for like 15 years. And I Googled her name. And when I Googled her name, that's when I found out she died. And but I got in contact with her family. And you gotta interview her brother, man, when you get the chance. My brother, he was in the military too. I got in contact with her brother and we were able to share the whole story of what happened. He shared with me how she was driving around the Bronx and sneak drug dealers and to tell drug dealers, listen, I see where your life is going, join the military. So she would do that. So I ran. So I was led to the right person at the right time. And here's another crazy part of that story. First, I went to the Marine Corps recruiter's office because in the Bronx, you know, all the offices are in like a strip mall, indoor strip malls. And so I went into the Marine Corps recruiter's office first and I sat down. And when I sat down, there was no one in there. There was coffee on the desk, but there was no one in there. And I sat there for like 15 minutes. And then I got up and left and went to the Navy recruiter's office. And when I went to the Navy recruiter's office, I run into the one recruiter that took a huge risk on me. And I was able to get into the military. So,
Wow. So you're, I know this about you just from hearing you speak before, and I can see why, but you are a man of faith. You're a strong believer in God. And, you know, just hearing about everything that happened in your life, even up to that point, that's just absolutely amazing. I mean, as far as the hand in your life and guiding you toward that position.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I truly believe it was all divine intervention. I fluctuated between 8 years in an agnosticism for until I was 26. And I truly believe that even though I didn't believe in God, I made fun of God, I mocked God, all of those things, like God was still with me because he knew what I would eventually become. And he knew how I would change. And he knew that I would be who I am today. So, man, it was the grace of God. I mean, when you think about it, just the odds of me hearing a voice telling me to join the military on a specific day, and then that day I go to this one recruiter. I mean, you know, and every other person who's joined the military knows. And when you go to those recruiters' offices, if you have anything on your record, they kick you out, right? They tell you to go right away. So, yeah, it was the hand of God, man.
Wow. So you go from there, and then you probably head out to Great Lakes training area for Navy boot camp. And then from there, is it straight to Buds or what did you do prior to that?
No, from there was, I couldn't swim. I wanted to go to Buds, but I couldn't swim. I didn't have the academic score and I was skinny. I could barely do a push-up. So I got stationed I went to A school first, which I was a corpsman. So I went to, right after boot camp, went to the corpsman A school, which was right across the street from NTC. And then I got stationed at Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton. So my first duty station was Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton. And that's where I really buckled down and trained. That's where I didn't have a car, but I would run 3 miles to the pool, jump in the pool. I almost drowned, but figure it out and learn, try to swim. Then I would run 3 miles back to my barracks. I would make up workouts and then I got an ASVAB for Dummies book and I would just study the ASVAB book and do that. And I would just, my life revolved around ASVAB book, working at the hospital, I worked in the family practice clinic and swimming and working out. And, I checked in January of 2003 and I checked out in January 2004 in Bucks. So that was kind of my journey. But, I went to Bucks twice, actually. The first time I went, I made it through first phase. I made it through Hell Week. Got to second phase, which was die phase. Well, I'll back up for a second. Prior to making it through Hell Week, I had failed every swim because I had just learned how to swim. And I remember just to get in the Buds, we had to do a 500-yard swim. But I never knew in preparing for Buds that you had to swim with fins. So when I checked in the Buds and I did the first swim with fins, I put those fins on and it was like I was drowning. I was like, what am I doing with these? I've never trained with these things. Like, you're supposed to, I thought you just have to do a 500-yard swim and then everything else was physical. I didn't know that you had to do a, so the ocean swim times, the passing time was 85 minutes. And I would take 120 minutes. I would fail every one of them. So after I made it through Hell Week, Bud's instructors, they decided to double roll me two classes to teach me how to swim with fins. So they double rolled me. I passed my swim in the first phase, but when I got the second phase, the swim times dropped from 85 minutes to 80 minutes, and I failed all my swims in second phase, and then I failed a test during pool week. So the instructors at that point was like, hey, dude, like, you're a good dude. You're hard. You do everything else, but you can't swim, so you can't be a SEAL. So I got kicked out of SEAL training. And then I went, that's when I went the first Marine Division at Camp Pendleton.
Wow. So you went through SEAL training once and then went back to 1st Marine Division.
Yeah. And then at this point, I went to 1st Marine Division. I was in the infantry. I was in Battalion 1-4. And I was in the scout sniper platoon for a little bit, but then I kept on getting the arguments and fights with the gunning sergeant because I didn't like authority and I didn't want to be there. So I got moved to 81s. But yeah, I did a year and a half there. And when I got back, you know, it was another whole God thing. My LPO, BAS, the battalion station, he ended up getting promoted while we were on deployment to first class. So when we got back from deployment, he got sent to the command career counselor's office. So he went from being in charge of 10 corpsmen to being in charge of like 500, 600 corpsmen at battalion for all of 1st Marine Division. So because he was my LPO and he knew I worked with Buds, he was just like, hey, dude, I'm going to hook you up. So because at the time, you had to do two deployments and get your FMF pin or do 3 years. So he's like, dude, he pushed my package right through. So when I got back from my first deployment, I went right back to Buds.
Oh, wow. And so during that time period, you know, you're going through deployment and everything like that with the Marine Corps. Were you training while you were on deployment? Was it just highly focused there? Where were you deployed to?
Yeah, so well, a few places. One, so I didn't knew, but a lot of it was we spent a lot of time in Kuwait because we were.
Gotcha.
I forgot what the exact term was, but there were a lot of casualties taking place in Iraq at the time. So we were on the Iraq Kuwaiti border. So I spent I spent like 3 months of deployment in Kuwait waiting to cross over. So I got a lot of great workout time in there. So I was in the gym. There wasn't a pool. I forgot the name of the base we were on, but there wasn't really a pool, but I was in the gym just crushing it. And then as soon as I got back from deployment, I was in the pool just getting after it, man.
Constantly. And then how was Bud's the second time?
It still sucked, but it was easier. It sucked. I mean, it sucked. It's bunt. I mean, and the funny thing was, there was a rumor going around, if you made it through Hell Week before, you don't have to go through Hell Week again. And that was a lie. So I had to go through everything all over again, the beatdowns, the surf tortures. And it was crazy because, you know, the attrition rate is like 80 to 90%. So, you know, my first class, I saw like hundreds of guys quit. My second class, I saw hundreds of guys quit the first time I was in Buds. And then I went back and I was in class again, hundreds of guys quit, you know, and then I'm still there. So it sucked. But, you know, I made it through and I was able to really apply a lot of the lessons that I had learned the first time around, the second time around. And I knew when Hell Week was going to end and I knew when certain evolutions were going to end because I'd been there before. But yeah, the class I ended up graduating with, they started out with 270. And 29 dudes, man.
Wow. Yeah. So that's like what, like 11-12% of everybody? Yeah. Wow.
That's the norm every class, man. 20 guys, 30 guys, 25 guys, you know, 270, 250 guys. That's the norm, man. So
and then what was next for you?
What was next was I went through at the Buds, I went to SQT, which was SEAL qualification training. And I got my Trident, and then I went to a team on the West Coast, and that's where I had my career, man. I was at one team, and I jumped to another specialized team for a little bit, and I jumped back to the same team I was at, and then you know, I finished out my career at another team. So yeah, I had a great career, man. I ended up doing a total of 3 deployments. All to the Middle East, you know. I try not to get into specifics because the Pentagon still hasn't cleared my book and I'm dealing with it. Yeah, man, I had a great time, man. Going down range, kicking down doors, doing direct action missions, reconnaissance missions. I was an intel guy, so I was also a guy who would wear civilian clothes and beard it up and go out with an MP5 or, you know, an M4 and do all kinds of, like, you know, sneaky peeky stuff. So I had a phenomenal career, man. I had a great time in SEAL teams, man.
Awesome. And so, yeah, I mean, we hear a lot more about this stuff now because the Navy SEALs are you know, we hear a lot about Navy SEALs these days ever since the war on terror started. And you know, life in the SEAL teams, it seems like it's constant deployments, constant training, constant trying to sharpen your sword, maintain that high status. You know, did you meet a lot of friends in the SEALs? Were there people who influenced you while you were there as far as, what your career should be like? What was that like?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's a brotherhood, man. Like, the crazy thing is, like, I'm closer to most guys I've either served with or went through bunch with than I am some of my own family members, man. And that's just the way it is because, you know, you go through hell together. It's hard to explain unless you're actually in it, but it's literally, it's like a brotherhood, man. It's like the Spartans. It's like, you know, the samurai. It's like, you know, you're more than brothers, you know? And so, there were so many guys who influenced me, inspired me, you know, I mean, SEALs go out, you have like people, you know, like Jocko Willings and all these other SEALs go out and speak and they inspire people. But just imagine being at work every day with the Jocko Willingses of the world the Madden's of the world and Jocko, he put my platoon through workup before we were deployed. And he kicked us in the nuts, man. And what workup is, you know, you have to go over a training cycle. Your platoon had to train in every realm before you deployed. So you had to do a skydiving as a team. You had to do diving as a team. You had to do, you know, close quarter combat shooting as a team. You had to do urban tactics as a team, land warfare as a team. And Jocko put our platoon through training one time before he retired. He put us through land warfare. And man, that's all I do, man. So, you go through all of this stuff and with these guys who are just all top notch, man, you know what I mean? It's hard to explain. It's almost like living in a dream and everybody's pushing everybody all the time. You're always challenged. You're always wanting to get better. You always want to shoot better. You always want to jump better. You always want to do things better because the guys around you always wanted to do things better. So, and everybody wants to do things with excellence. So it's a whole nother world. It's a whole nother level that, man, unless you're you're in it, you don't really understand it. And you know, when I go and speak at Jocko and you have these other guys who go out and speak and you're just getting a glimpse of what it is to be in that community. It's a phenomenal community, you know. And to this day, you know, like, I'm super close to with a lot of guys I went through training with or deploy with, you know. You know, their kids hang out with my kids, or their wives and my wives get together. Their wives are best friends and stuff. So it's like our own little community, man.
So what, if there's any one lesson that you learned from being a Navy SEAL that's really served you in, you know, the rest of your life, what do you think that would be?
So many. I mean, there's like a million lessons, but the one that comes to mind is care about your people. Mm-hmm. Just care about your people. I had a lieutenant, he's a platoon commander, he's a phenomenal leader. We call him Mr. T. And that dude, he just cared about us. Like, you have some leaders who look at their subordinates as stepping stones to get to the next rank, or they want their platoon to be stellar so that they look good in front of the higher up so that they can get a promotion or get a CO billet or XO billet or whatever. But this dude, he wasn't about that. He was just all about the people. And their personal life, like how are things going on at home? How are things going on with you? Like, what can I do to serve you? And that really stuck with me. Really did. And to this day, that's something that I try to do, whether I'm on a movie set or whether I'm, you know, with my sister here. I try to show a genuine interest in the people that I'm working alongside of, and especially the people who are working for me, so that they know that I don't just see them as a tool that I'm using to get what I want, but I see them as a person with a soul. And I'm not here to just lead them, but I'm here to serve them, you know. So that's one lesson. I mean, another one is do do things right the first time. I mean, that's something that they teach us in Buds, bro. Is do things right the first time. And because if you don't, you're going to have to do it all over again. So you're going to waste your own time having to do it all over again. So that's something that I try to do every single day in my life. I try to do things with excellence. You know what I mean? Whether I'm writing a screenplay, whether I'm, you know, that's something that, you know, I've been dealing with, because I just finished writing this film, and I'm about to send it out to different directors and producers in the industry. And I was just on a call earlier today with a major film company. And if I said that company's name, everybody would know who it is. And they were like, you know, send us your stuff, send us your screenplay. We want to read it. We're eager. And I said, just give me a few days, because even though it's done, because I have this Navy SEAL mindset to do things with excellence, I want it to be excellent. So I sent it out to some producer friends, some writer friends, and I said, hey, I want you to read it, vet it, give me your feedback, I'll implement it, then I'll send it out. So, you know, here I am. I have one of the biggest film companies in the world wanting to read my film, and I could just hand it to them. But I'm like, no, I'll be patient and wait, because I want things to be done right. And that's, again, that goes back to my training. Communication is something that, you know, was a massive lesson. It's not just about what you communicate. It's about how you communicate what you communicate. I learned that because I worked intel. You know, I had to work through with locals who didn't speak my language. And I had to work through interpreters. I had to collect information that, if I collected wrong, could potentially mean the difference between life and death of me and my teammates, because we were using that information to go on mission. So, you know, another big lesson I learned is, again, it's not just about what you communicate, it's about how you communicate what you communicate. And sometimes the way we communicate, it's in a way that we understand because it's the way we live, but it's not always the way the person to our right, to our left understands, even if they're speaking the same language. And so those are just three that I could spot off the top. But yeah, man, so many lessons.
No, that's absolutely amazing advice and amazing insight. I got to ask you this, because, you know, you went through your career and then, you know, you were led out of the SEALs into the civilian world. What made you decide to leave, and what was it like, for you when you stepped out?
I stepped out in 2016, and there were like two things that really, it was a combination of things. One was, my kids. So my first son was born in 2014. My second son was born in 2015. And my dad died when I was five, as I've shared. And I just was like, I need to be around you. I need to be home. I don't know why, but I know what it's like to not have a father in the house. And, you know, not that I was fearful of dying, but just being gone as much as you are as a SEAL, you're just gone a lot. That's just the reality of it. And, you know, I had just finished come off a time where I was kind of like somewhat of a shorty type deal. And I was just like, and I was supposed to, you know, get ready to deploy and all that. And I was just like, I got to be home. And so that was one of the reasons why I got out, was because I needed to be home with my kids. Secondly, I just felt like, you know, I prayed about it, and my wife prayed about it. And I felt like God was telling me, you know, it's time to move on. And it wasn't what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I was living a dream. You know what I mean? From bronze to the SEAL teams, having a great time, a great career. And so, you know, I didn't want to leave, but, you know, I obeyed that voice, and, you know, I got out January 2016. And then 3-4 months later, I got put in the movie. So
The thing, because I'm picturing you getting out, you're trying to figure out exactly what you're going to do. You've got a new family, right? Young family. And so that's always something that probably weighs upon any father's mind is if I get out, what am I going to do next? But then there's this huge, massive opportunity as far as getting into the movies. How did that all come about?
Yeah, that's a whole crazy story, man. So I got out in January, man, like I was struggling financially. I was like trying to figure out. My wife, because she's a doctor, but, you know, it was just one of those things where, you know, you can't, I'm a man. I can't just have my wife pay all the bills and provide, you know, and my kids. So I struggled, and I started to apply for the agency, for the CIA. And it's a crazy story because I was going through the interview process and going through, you know, filling out the paperwork and everything. And then everything was going well with the guy, with the recruiter. And then all of a sudden, like, he just dropped off the map and he stopped communicating with me. So I figured, you know what, I didn't qualify for the job. And it was a bit contradictory because I got out of the military. It's partly to spend time with my wife and kids. But here I am going back into a field that was going to take me away, you know, 3 to 4 months on and then 3 to 4 months off, you know. But anyway, that happened. And then a good friend of mine who was a SEAL, we went through buds together. We deployed together. He got killed in Iraq. And when I went to his memorial service, the SEAL approached me and at the end of the service, respectfully, of course, and he's just like, "Hey man, there's some people throwing your name around up in Hollywood. They're trying to get you on a project." I'm like, "Throwing my name around. I'm not, I was in grad school at the time. I was, you know, finishing up my master's in strategy. And so I had not been in Hollywood. I had not been thinking about being in Hollywood." Mm-hmm. And so when he said that, I was like a bit surprised. And he was like, "Hey, let me get your number." And I was so standoffish. I was just like, I didn't give him my number to pass on to this whoever. So eventually he ended up getting my number from another SEAL, and he passed it on to this person in the film industry who had been looking for me. And this person called me, and one day when I was writing papers for grad school, I said, "Hey, what are you doing tomorrow?" I was like, "Well, I've got school tomorrow." He's like, "Hey, you want to be in a movie?" I was like, "Sure, what is it?" She's like, "Transformers." I was like, "Oh, okay." And so she said, I was like, "Ah, I think I can make that happen." So she said, "Send me some pictures." I sent her some pictures, just random pictures, not headshots or anything professional, just random pictures. And then she had emailed me back. She said, "Michael Bay, whose first two films inspired me to be a SEAL," right? They're full circle the moment. He's like, "Michael Bay, show your pictures. We want you on set tomorrow." Mm-hmm. Sure. So the next day, I'm on set with Michael Bay shooting the first scenes for Transformers. And then it was just supposed to be two weeks later, she called me back and said, "Michael Bay wants to keep you on. Are you available to fly to Arizona?" So I went to Arizona and filmed out there for a week. And then I went to Michigan, filmed in Michigan for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, one of the production assistants approached me and said, "Hey, Bay wants to keep you on until we wrap filming." So I was like, I stayed on and until back in December of 2016. That was 2016. And then, yeah, man, and that just opened up so many doors. Wow. So many doors from Transformers opened up, and that's how I kind of went. So I signed an endorsement deal with Jockey, and then that's the Transformers movies what led to my book deal with HarperCollins. And then, you know, I got other commercials and all this other stuff to where I'm at now. So that's kind of how I got to end. I was not trying to get hit up on Instagram all the time from people who are trying to be actors, and they're like, "I want to be an actor. I'm just struggling trying to figure out." Like, you know, I'm like, "Dude, like, don't ask me, dude. Like, I snuck in the back door and without even knowing what door I was sneaking into. Somebody, you know, I was trying to get into this business." So
That's amazing. How did they find your name in the first place? Were there people talking about you? Were you in like a database or something like that?
Well, it was through the SEAL network because there's a lot of work in the industry for SEALs, and not just SEALs, but Delta, Special Forces guys to consult on films so the films look more realistic. So Michael Bay was not just looking for people, he was looking for real SEALs like to be in the film as roles and, you know, consult as well. And so it was through the SEAL network. One of the guys who worked with Bay, he was a former SEAL, so he heard about me, and I guess they were looking for some diversity in the film, so they were looking for African-American SEALs, so that's kind of how they got on me then.
Awesome. Yeah. Now, with your book, Transformed, it goes through your story, and what is it you're trying to convey to the reader with this book? Because I assume whenever you get a book's a fabulous thing because it can implant an idea. It can inspire people. What kind of transformation, so to speak, are you looking for in the reader?
Man, so much, man. I wrote the book. I wrote every word of the book. I didn't have a ghostwriter, and even my editor, when I turned my book into her, she read it and she was just like, "It's not much for me to do." And you know, I say that humbly, but I say that because I think it's, you know, not every writer writes their book, but I wrote my book and I wrote it intentionally, and there were a few messages that I wanted people to get across. One was, you know, when you look at my story, you'll see that there were people that came into my life during different parts of my story, from the recruiter, a mom, obviously, you know, the guy who ended up being a career counselor. And there's so many other people, I call them heroes, you know, even Michael Bay, who like was like, hey, come be my mom. There are all of these people who came into my life that helped me to get to where I am today. And so one of the messages is that I want to share is that, you know, be that extending hand to somebody in need, you know, because people always tell me, hey, Remy, you're inspiring, you do this, you do that. I'm just like, yeah, but I wouldn't be here or who I was if it wasn't for these 200 people that you will never, ever know. You know what I'm saying? And so, you know, one of the messages I try to get across is go help that kid. If you see a kid that you don't know, or you see a kid struggling, or you're a judge, or you're a, you know, police officer, you're a doctor, or you're the neighbor of a kid, or you're the neighbor of somebody, you just go. You never know how what you can do, or maybe even just what you can say can change the trajectory of that person's life. So that's one big message. And another one is, you know, in the book is, you know, we may not be the one that changes the world, but it may be what we say to that person, that one person, who then becomes the one who changes the world. And that's another message, you know. Perseverance is obviously, when you read the book, when people that read the book, they're just gonna be like, oh my gosh, like, you went through hell over and over and over and over again, and you're still here. And when I was writing the book, dude, I was just like, I can't believe I went through all of this stuff I went through and still didn't quit and didn't give up, you know? And I get that's the heart of the book is never quit, dude. Like, never, ever give up. Like, you're going to have setbacks in life. You're going to be so close to the finish line and something is going to happen and you're going to have to start all over again, but do it. Like, it is worth it in the end. Yes, the pain sucks. Yes, the setbacks, the failure, the having to go back home to your family and friends and say, I didn't make it. Yeah, that sucks. But you know what? There's always tomorrow. And pick your head up and take a day off and then get back into the next phase. So, you know, but don't quit. I think that's a big part of the message is perseverance. And then also, you know, I can make it with all of the setbacks I've had in my life, coming from Africa, single parent home, you know, involved in the stuff I was involved in. And you can make it. Like, there's no excuse. You know, I get hit up from people all over the world, you know, especially in Africa where I come from, and they say, oh, I can't, like, things are not going well in my life, or my government doesn't help me, or this and that, like, I can't make it. And I'm just like, no, there's always a way. I don't care what, and some people are going to probably hear this and be like, no, it's not right that you say that, but I'm just of the belief that there is always a way to make it out the situation you're in. You may not like that way, but there is a way. I have a cousin of mine, and I'll say this, you know, he's always found himself in bad situations that he has put himself in. And I have given him so much money over the years. I have given him thousands of dollars. And it's gotten to a point where I so told this kid, I said, you are not getting a nickel from me ever again to call me up crying as much as you want. You got all the people get. And one day he called me up crying and he was a mess because he was out of money and he has kids and he has this and that going on. And he's just like, there's no way I can make it out of this situation. There's no way I can pay my bills. There's no way I could do this. And I said, have your legs work? He said, yeah. I said, do you have access to a plastic bag? He said, yeah. I said, okay. You want to make it out of the situation you're in? He said, yeah. I said, okay, here's a plan. There's a park by your house, I'm sure, because I've been in your house before. Walk through that park, dig in a garbage can, and pull out cans. Mm-hmm. Go to another garbage can and pull out cans. You do that all day long. You take those cans from a recycling center, you will get 5 cents per can. Will it suck? Will it be humiliating? Absolutely. But will you be more in the positive than you were before you started that? Yes, you will. And even if you make $20, $30, $40, that is something that you can use to invest in something else, even if it's investing in gas so that you can drive somewhere to go get a better job. But you can get out You just have to be willing to do the messy, humiliating work. I'm not talking about something that goes against your convictions, like prostitution or, you know what I mean, selling drugs or anything ridiculous. I'm talking about the humility, mopping floors, working at McDonald's, whatever it is, so that you can make that money to get to that next step. The issue isn't that people can't, you know, make it out. It's just that they don't put in the work, you know? And they're not willing to do the extra hard work. Now, granted, there are countries where I've been to some third world countries where it just sucks. It's bad. I mean, it's almost impossible to get ahead. But for the most part, I'm just of the belief that there is always a way.
That's so true, man. That is such a good message to have and such a good message to convey to everybody. There is always a way. I mean, I've been through situations like that. I was living out of my car at one point. I was hopeless, feeling like, you know, nobody in the world cared about my situation, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter until I started caring about my situation and I started putting work into myself and doing the things necessary to move myself forward. And, you know, what I see in you is that, you know, somebody could look at your story in a bunch of different ways. If they look at you when you were a teenager, they look at you as being a product of your environment.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you look at it right now, if you look back as an adult, your environment was training you the whole time. Your environment was honing this thing inside of you. And now you get a chance to put it out there. And now you get a chance, because if you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth, and then you,
which I was.
Well, yeah, you were, but if it stayed there, right? And then you became a Navy SEAL and all this stuff. I mean, sure, people care about Navy SEALs and absolutely it's huge. But the story you have now, that's such an amazing story to say, I came from the Bronx, I was selling drugs, I was, you know, at the bottom of the barrel, and then I was able to turn my life around and become one of the best of the best. That's amazing, man.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you, man. To God be the glory and, you know, hard work, man.
I just want to say this before we jump off. Most of our listeners here are combat veterans, U.S. Marine Corps, U.S. Army. And what do you have to say to them? Because some of these guys, as you know, have been going through some hard times themselves. What's the one piece of advice you could say to those guys who are either on the verge of getting out or who just got out of the military and they're going to start their new lives right now?
Well, I would say a few things, man. I would say if you're just getting out, or you're about to get out, education. I'm a big believer in education. Please, I tell veterans all the time, before you get out, take advantage of 100% TA while you're in. Even if it's just to get your associates or get, you know, non-important stuff out, just get some education and use your post-9/11 GI Bill. And the reason why I say that is because we as veterans, especially combat veterans, we have critical thinking skills. We have team building skills. We have all these skills just that we acquired over the years that you cannot acquire anywhere else but on the battlefield. Or maybe even if you didn't, you know, get a chance to go down range and get shot and do all that kind of stuff, you still have skills that you've acquired over the years by supporting those who've gone down range or from, you know, training. And so if you can match those skills with education, you are an asset. You know, I remember before getting out, I didn't want to go to college because I was just like, oh my goodness, like I already have it all. I grew up in the Bronx, I got street smarts, I became a SEAL, I know all of this stuff. But when I got my degree and when I went and got my master's, it just gives you so much more credibility and it just opens up so many doors for you. So many doors for me because people want to hire veterans, and especially a veteran who's educated. So, you know, education is important to me and my family. And so that's one of the big things I would say, you know, have your education plan worked out and start taking advantage of that TA so that you can use your post 9/11 GI Bill for part of your bachelor's, your master's, and your PhD. Second thing I would say is, you know, have a plan in place. Have an idea of what you want to do. I talked to, you know, some of my buddies, mainly guys who are not, you know, SEALs, but, you know, some guys who, a lot of guys who support me got out and they're just like, man, you know, I'm jumping from this job and that job and this job, and I don't really know what I want to do, and I'm going through problems in my marriage because, you know, my wife wants me to do something. And I'm like, man, like trying before you get out or when you get out, like, think about, okay, what are my skills? What are the things that I like to do that I will be able to do and not be miserable? That won't be like a job to me. Because for me, when I was in the SEAL teams, I wasn't a job to me. I mean, I was just living and then getting a paycheck. Now, like, I don't work for anybody. I don't. Like, I work for myself. You know, I sign a publishing deal with HarperCollins that pays me money. You know, I speak and I get paid for that. You know, I'm just writing a film that I've been blessed to be able to sit at this very computer and write and not have to worry about how I'm going to keep my lights on because of the way I've taken care of my money and also because of how I set myself up from a business perspective. And so, you know, but I say all that to say is I hate the weekends. I do. I hate the weekends. I love spending time with my wife and my kids and having a weekend for my family. But come Sunday, I'm just like, man, I'm ready to get back to Monday because I love the thrill of doing what I do every day and being able to work for myself and being able to write myself checks. You know, I don't have an S corporation, so I write myself checks. So, be smart with your money. That's another thing I tell veterans. Be smart with your money. I've known veterans in, and they get out, voila, they're in. They get back from deployment. They buy that freaking Mustang or they buy that whatever, and they burn this money. And yeah, that Mustang looks good for 2 years, but you know what? After 2 years, new one's going to come out. No one's going to be thinking about that Mustang anymore. Take your money and invest it or save it. So that when you get out, you can afford to have time to figure out what you want to do if you haven't figured out yet. Or you could take that money and invest in your business. Mm-hmm. Invest in your business. You know, I am of the belief that every single, and again, I might take a hit on this, but this is my personal belief. This is not biblical doctrine. This is my personal belief. I am of the belief that every veteran has the potential to start his or her business when they get out. That's my personal belief. Even if it's just you starting an S corporation that's in your last name, you know, Adelaide Enterprises, and going out and doing consulting, or going out and training people for, you know, running them through workouts, or going out and speaking in different conferences, or creating something, and then taking that money and investing it back in your business so that you can write your own checks. It's not that hard to get incorporated, and it's not that hard to begin to build a brand, even if it's through like what you're doing with your podcast, so that you can invest in yourself and create your own wealth instead of go work for somebody and yeah, make $60,000-$80,000 a year, but you're still working for somebody and you can't get that far. Another reason why I got out, and this was, you know, really a reason that I thought about at the time, but it was something that when looking back, I thought about. There were a lot of people that told me when I got out, like senior chiefs in the office, man, what are you going to do when you get out, man? Like, man, you're so cool. Because I got out at 13 and a half years. Mm-hmm. And they're like, man, like, you're going to be retirement. You're pissing away your retirement and this and that. And, you know, when I think about it, I'm making more now than in 1 year than I will probably make in 15 years or 20 years of retirement.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know what I'm saying? But if I stayed in, and yeah, you know, as a SEAL, you make good money. If I stayed in, that amount of money wouldn't equate over time what I can make in 1 year by investing in myself and investing in my own business.
Right.
You know, so it's like you have to make a choice as to whether you want to work for somebody and you know, you're going to have a ceiling that amount of money that you can make. Or whether to get out and invest in your business or invest in something that inspires you, or maybe even if it's a nonprofit, or stay in and work for somebody. I can't work for anybody. I will never work for anybody ever again for the rest of my life.
I won't either. I learned that right after I got out of the Marine Corps. I just can't do it. And that's not, I have nothing against anybody who wakes up every day and earns their money, but it's just not me. It's just not me anymore.
It's not me. Much respect to those who do it. You know, it takes, you know, special calling. That's not me. I have no disrespect to anybody that does that, because again, we need those people who are willing. We need the police officers. We need the doctor. My wife's a doctor. We need the lawyers. We need the garbage men. We need, you know, all of these different people to do what they do in order for society to thrive and exist. So I'm not minimizing that in any way. I'm just saying that, you know, for myself personally, I just felt like this. That's just me. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, and I think it's important to realize that, like you said, I think any veteran has the ability to have their own business. I also think it's important to understand that, you know, you don't have to, it doesn't necessarily have to be entertainment or movies or anything like that. What Remy's telling you right now could be applied to anything. All of you probably got some knowledge in your head that other people could benefit from, whether that's physical fitness, whether that's organizational skills, whether that's leadership skills you learn, all right? And one thing I want to add here, just because I see it in you, and it's implied, but you didn't talk about it today, but it is implied. Make sure you marry the right woman and have a good relationship. I think that that's important to understand, because I could see it in you. I could see it in the smile on your face that you have a happy home.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. That's key. You got to marry the right woman. You're going to be the right partner. But yeah, you know, yeah, you know, it's good to have a great partner who supports you and who you support. And you know what? I'm going to be honest. Marriage isn't easy. Right. It's not going to be easy. I'll be the first one to admit it. Me and my wife, we've gone through our challenges. You know, she's super, you know, strong-willed. I'm super strong-willed. And it's a blessing and a curse to have two strong-willed people married. But yeah, man, I have a great partner. Me and my wife, we've been married for 7 years, you know. She's a trooper. She's pregnant with our third son. So we have about to have another boy. And you know what? You are absolutely right, man. You know, when you choose that person, be wise and be patient. And don't just get with somebody for the wrong reason because they have money or they have this or they have that. You know, get with them for the right reason so that, you know, we can live that long lasting life together and enjoy each other, support, serve each other.
Outstanding. You know, Remy, one, I want to thank you for coming in today. Your book, Transformed, it is going to be out April 16th. Am I right?
Yeah, April 16th. So April 16th, 2019. I apologize for all those who already pre-ordered and you were expecting the January 20th podcast. You know, the Pentagon had to read my book. It was supposed to be done in July, August, and here we are, you know, months later, and it's still not reviewed for me to publish. I can't publish it. We have to move the release date to April 16th. However, if you go to transformedstory.com, and you pre-order the book, I am giving away exclusive content right now in the form of videos that the general public are not receiving. There are other videos, exclusive stories, and what I call them cutting room floor stories, and these are all stories that didn't make it into the book. And they're not told by me. They're told by people who have been a part of my life since the beginning of time. but yeah, if you pre-order the book, you'll have access to that. And later, as we get closer to release date, we're going to release other exclusive content, such as, you know, a chapter read and other stuff like that. So go ahead and pre-order on transformstory.com.
Outstanding. Yeah, and we'll get all the links for that up on the show notes. To everybody out there in the audience, thank you for listening today. And like I said, there's a lot of gems in this conversation, ranging in everything from the life lessons that Remy's learned all the way up to talking about business. Please get out there, apply these things. You know, don't just sit here and listen. Apply these things to your own life and get out there and live your best life while you can. Thanks, everybody. And thank you, Remy.
Thank you, my brother. God bless and much love. Bye, everybody. Thanks for having me. Hit me up on social media, Remy Adelake, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn.
Absolutely. We'll get those up on the show notes as well.
Yes, sir.